Welcome to the Plain Label Podcast Pod Shots.
Yes. Yes. And if I win, you show me the way out. Yes.
Yes. Yes. And if it loses, what then?
If it loses,
precious, then we eat it. If Baggins loses, we eat it whole.
Fair enough.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Podshots. I'm your host, Eric Williams. For this episode, we are discussing the 2012 film The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. Written by Fran Walsh, Peter Jackson, Philippa Boyens, and Guillermo del Toro, the film was directed by Peter Jackson and, of course, is based on the book created by, or book and world created by J.R.R. Tolkien. Here to discuss the film with me are two returning guests. The first you know from this show discussing Luther and Serenity, as well as being a host of Sidebar, Mr. Dwight Clark.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
And our next guest, I like the laugh afterwards, especially. Our next guest was on this show discussing the original Sam Raimi Spider-Man trilogy, as well as the Mark Webb helmed relaunch The Amazing Spider-Man. He is comic book writer-artist, Mr. Scotty Young.
Hello!
Before getting into our discussion, I would like to mention that this podcast is brought to you by the Deliberate Noise Network. Head over to deliberatenoise.com and check out some of the other shows that are over there. And this podcast is also sponsored by Audible. For you, the listeners of Plain Label Podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download along with a free 30-day trial. For this episode, our Audible recommendation is, of course, The Hobbit. Written by J.R.R. Tolkien, the audiobook is narrated by the great and wonderful Rob Inglis. The unabridged reading of the book is over 11 hours long, and it can be yours for free. To download your free audiobook, go to audibletrial.com/plainlabel. Again, that's audibletrial.com/plainlabel for your free audiobook. So let's go ahead and get into the drink roll call quickly. Scotty, let's start with you. What do you have?
I have an Angry Orchard hard cider, the crisp apple variety.
And that's your purchase. That's not Casey's purchase, right?
No. I always get chuckles.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. It has exactly the same amount of alcohol as any other beer that anybody drinks, right, except it tastes like apple juice and not like shit. Like most beer. So I drink apple juice and get faded, and everybody else drinks whatever kind of hipster microbrew that they're trying to swallow and pretend that tastes well.
Dwight, what about you?
Well, I'm drinking a Middle Earth beer, also known as malt beer.
Nice.
It's crisp and goes down smoothly.
Okay. I am luckily, since Scotty was talking trash about the micro beers, not going with one of those. I have from Leinenkugel's, I have the orange shandy. So it's kind of hipstery because it's, you know, beer with some orange in it.
I haven't actually had the orange shandy. I do really enjoy the summer shandy though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good. Yeah, I mean it's kind of like a Blue Moon that you would get with an orange slice in it. It's kind of like that.
You'll have to try the orange.
Yeah, it's not bad. And Leinenkugel's is pretty cheap, so it's not one of those Niesmann-esque, you know, micro brews that'll cost you like $15 or whatever.
Right.
So, okay, with that, I think we're ready to begin our discussion on the 2012 film The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey.
My dear Frodo, you asked me once if I had told you everything there was to know about my adventures. Well, I can honestly say I have told you the truth. I may not have told you all of it.
Bilbo Baggins, I'm looking for someone to share in an adventure.
I can't just go running off into the blue. I am a Baggins.
Wait!
Of Baggins.
Bilbo, allow me to introduce Fili, Kili, Oin, Loin, Darlin, Barlin, Biffa, Bofa, Bomba, Dory, Nori, Ori. And the leader of our company, Thorin Oakenshield.
Far over the misty mountains cold, to dungeons deep and caverns old, like torches blazed with light.
I cannot guarantee his safety.
Understood.
Nor will I be responsible for his fate.
Tale or two to tell when you come back.
Can you promise that I will come back?
No. And if you do, you will not be the same.
My name is Bilbo Baggins.
Bagginses. What is a Bagginses? Precious.
And the IMDb plot synopsis for the film is as follows. Bilbo Baggins is swept into a quest to reclaim the lost dwarf kingdom of Erebor from the fearsome dragon Smaug. Approached out of the blue by the wizard Gandalf the Grey, Bilbo finds himself joining a company of 13 dwarves led by the legendary warrior Thorin Oakenshield. Their journey will take them into the wild through treacherous lands swarming with goblins and orcs, deadly wargs and giant spiders, shapeshifters and sorcerers. Although their goal lies to the east into the wastelands of the Lonely Mountain, first they must escape the goblin tunnels where Bilbo meets the creature that will change his life forever, Gollum. Here alone with Gollum, on the shores of an underground lake, the unassuming Bilbo Baggins not only discovers depths of guile and courage that surprise even him, he also gains possession of Gollum's precious ring that holds unexpected and useful qualities. A simple gold ring that is tied to the fate of Middle-earth in ways Bilbo cannot begin to know. So, in terms of IMDb, that one's not too bad. Some of them are just fucking terrible in terms of their plot synopsises. But, Dwight, I'll start with you. I know this is a film that you had suggested that you would be willing to talk about many moons ago, like once it had come out almost a year ago now. Or a little over a year ago now. So what is it that you are so excited about this film? Or are you a big Lord of the Rings guy in general? Or sort of give me your history about the world of Tolkien.
Okay. Well, you want the Silmarillion history, or do you want just a brief history? No,
I think he's letting out a spoiler with that comment.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a fan of Tolkien's work since I was in high school, man, reading Silmarillion first for a book report, which was extremely hard because it's not one of those sequitured books you can really read in that manner, and was really kind of chastised and moved away from it by my teacher to go into the simpler tales, if you will, of Lord of the Rings and the Fellowship and so on and so forth. And so I've always liked the concept and idea. I like fantasy and science fiction anyway, and fantasy in this particular manner was very it was untypified compared to what I usually read, because it revolved around a believable world which centered here on Earth a long, long time ago in a historical fashion, and it had a language which was kind of difficult at times but also kind of very entrancing and ingratiating. I liked the ideas of the concept of rings of power and being controlled by those things, and without giving any spoilers, I mean, everybody knows now, especially the way the last Lord of the Rings film ended, that there's the one ring and these other rings are controlled by it. And I kind of wanted to see them get more into that in The Hobbit, but I don't think they will, because it never truly was discussed in that manner fully. I mean, there were elements of it which were, of course, fully discussed, and there were elements which weren't. You can only do so much inside of a three-hour film. So, I mean, in my attempt to talk about this, I kind of want to, of course, lean more towards what the films were doing versus what the books were doing, because you can't equate the two together. There's right. two different animals. Mm-hmm. Anytime you're doing an adaptation, you know, you're going to have to leave some things out, and people don't like that. Some people get butthurt by it, you know. some people understand that it's a transformative process that you have to go through, and, you know, I just fully let myself go and just watch the movie for movie's sake, unlike other things which I hold dear. On my other on the podcast, Sidebar, that I'm on, I always, the X-Men are a linchpin for me as far as me getting pissed off about something, as far as movies go. But I thoroughly enjoy the Tolkien films for what they are, as far as adaptations done by Peter Jackson and crew. The reason I said I would jump on this podcast with no problems is because I don't get a chance to discuss these things with my boys, so to speak, because they're not into Tolkien the way I am. So, anytime I have an opportunity to discuss them with the other people, I'm willing to do that. And so that's why I'm here.
Gotcha. Scotty, what about you? What's your history with Lord of the Rings and then The Hobbit?
Mine actually is exact opposite. I came to them with the first trilogy of movies and, you know, fell in love with those. And Casey and I always look forward to those each Christmas when they came out. So that was always kind of our Christmas thing that we do with her family. We'd all go see each of those movies. And
that's cool.
So we checked those out. That became a holiday tradition. And then as the extended editions came out, I always look forward to those. And when those were first coming out, I was pretty young in my comic book career. So, a lot of hours spent at the drawing table and having those really long movies. And then, you know, the 20 plus hours of making of footage that they had was fantastic, because you just start popping in those appendices and you just keep it on in the background, and you're learning about storytelling and, you know, they really get into a lot of extra stuff, and you start learning a lot more about Tolkien and, you know, his thought process and their thought process. And so that's really how I came to him. Sadly, I still have never jumped into those, to the novels. I did go and do The Hobbit. I do a lot of audiobooks while I draw.
Mm-hmm.
I did do The Hobbit before The Hobbit movie came out. But yeah, so for me, it was just the movies. I fell in love with them. Mm-hmm. Then checked out The Hobbit novel and really dug that. And then checked out the Hobbit movies, obviously. And it's just one of those things where you're just kind of in awe that they accomplished something so big and vast. It was kind of interesting because at the same time they were launching the Harry Potter trilogies, but the Harry Potter franchise as well in film. So you had these two kind of massive franchises happening at the same time starting at the same time of each other. And they both kind of really accomplished their goals, you know, mm-hmm. where a lot of times things like this, you know, like, you know, right before that we had The Matrix. So, you know, which did not accomplish its goals. so it was really cool for me just to kind of have this thing that I didn't have any expectations for. Obviously, being a part of the world that I'm a part of, you're familiar with it, but having never dove in, it was really cool just to be like, I have no baggage. I'm going to walk into these blind and see what I think, and just love them.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I don't, for the audience, I don't want to rehash again because I feel like I've done that in every one of these shows. But for you two, like, I came to it very similar to what Scotty did. Like, I apparently was one of the few high schools, I don't know if it's a Midwestern thing or what, but I didn't have The Hobbit on the syllabus in high school, and apparently a lot of people do. And so I had never checked that out. I knew of The Ring, but I had no really extensive prior knowledge before going to the Lord of the Rings, and loved that, and, you know, listened to the audiobook on a long drive for The Two Towers and read The Return of the King before it came out.
Nice.
And then for The Hobbit, I've had the book forever, and I have started reading it. I'm not very far in, so most of what was in this film was still new.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of nice because I could sort of get a sense of what they were covering and what they were glossing over. And so, you know, I had like a little bit of knowledge, but not so much to where I was going to hold it dear if they missed something or didn't include something. And so, I don't know. That's been nice. I'm going to see, as of recording, I'm going to see Smaug tomorrow. So, I don't have any knowledge about what's going to happen in that. So,
and I won't spoil it for you. Scott, have you seen it yet?
I have seen Smaug. Yeah.
What'd you think?
Silence is deafening.
Yeah, like we were talking about this today. Me and Jason Howard and Jake Parker were talking about it, and I feel like the further I get away from having seen it, I'm liking it less. And I we'll talk more about it compared to this one, because I feel it's really what I loved about this one the unexpected journey, mm-hmm. it lacked the things that I loved about the first one. And so that's why I was a little disappointed. I can't say that I disliked it. I mean, I still enjoyed it, mm-hmm. but just not like the way that I did Unexpected Journey.
Okay.
It just felt more in line with the original trilogy. Mm-hmm. It felt like that tone. And again, I don't want to get too much if you're getting ready to see it tomorrow. I don't want to ruin it for you, but, it just felt more that tone than the tone of The Hobbit. Okay. Unexpected Journey. I felt like the tone of Unexpected Journey was kind of setting its own path and saying, you've seen The Lord of the Rings and that's this kind of seriousness and this kind of thing, but this is a different, this is in that universe, but it's a little bit different, which is what the book is, right? I mean, the book doesn't carry that same gravitas and tone that the three Lord of the Rings books.
No, right? By far. No, sure. By far they definitely don't. Yeah.
Right. And that's how I felt the first movie was. Felt the movie, you know, kind of captured that children's book-esque tone that mm-hmm. that the Hobbit book had. And I really, really enjoyed that. And mm-hmm. we'll talk more about that once we jump into the movie. But yeah, so I was just disappointed. It's not that I disliked it. Or hated it or anything like that. I had super high expectations for how much I loved Unexpected Journey, and that probably was not great on my part because I left feeling a little empty.
Mm.
What'd you think?
Well, like you said, I don't want to spoil it for Eric, but I mean, I do think that there are some really high highs and some really low lows. I think in terms of my expectation for what happened, it was a little too long for me.
It was way too long
for the way that it ended. It was like, okay, that's it. You know, yeah. mm-hmm. It's like this crazy cliffhanger that was almost harkens back to Kirshner and Empire Strikes Back, like that kind of thing. Like, okay, let's wait till the next time to find out what happens. It's like, well, geez, guys, we know already that the story is only supposed to be one book anyway and not three films. So, but at the same time, I realized you have to take, certain monetary concerns. And of course,
sure.
The big wigs get involved and it becomes something else bigger than what it really was supposed to be. So, and who's, I can't say I'm sad by having three more Hobbit films or three Peter Jackson-esque, you know, Tolkien films. I mean, I'm grateful for that. So, but, it was a little long. I did find certain things kind of disconcerting and weird, which I won't go into.
You know what made it feel long was the thing that made it feel most long is that if you watched, which I watched Hobbit again, Unexpected Journey, right before I went in.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like that movie at clocking in at like 3 hours does mm-hmm. not, you do not feel that length. Like
right.
for some, like this pacing of that movie is at such a nice clip that mm-hmm. I never felt the length of the first Hobbit movie. And mm-hmm. so then going in to see Smaug, man, I really felt it. I remember sitting in the theater like, I can't remember a time before I got here. This is lasting a long time.
I mean, so you guys watched the extended version of the Unexpected Journey?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you, Scotty?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, cool.
I've seen both. I've seen, obviously, I saw it in the theater twice, and then I've watched the extended version.
Okay. Because I watched the extended version like 2 nights ago, and I have to say there was a lot more material in there that was more humorous than what I expected.
Yeah.
A little more sing-songy than what I thought they were going to do as far as what Peter Jackson was going to apply to it. Mm-hmm. But I did like those touches, even though I think it was obviously longer. It felt longer to me. Like certain things, like, I mean, I guess are we going to go ahead and get into the film now?
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
Like the dwarves frolicking in the pool at Rivendale. It's like, okay, butt naked. That was okay. Yeah.
I noticed that in the credits where it says fleeting nudity. And it's like, fleeting nudity? Like, what in the world?
I was like, okay, I could have done without that. You know, it was kind of expected that to some degree because I guess he's trying to add some sense of levity to it because in the books, they're a little more playful, a little more, childlike and innocent than what they are in the movies. They're very mission oriented and gregarious and kind of frustrated, misplaced people in the movies, you know. So that's kind of cool. But anyway, I think the pieces, some of the parts that were cut out were obviously very, very integral to understanding the movie. I guess going back to the very beginning, Eric, if you want to take us through that, with the Elf King.
I was so surprised when I saw that part, and I was like, why did they cut that out? It made it make so much more sense.
Yeah. The rift, that whole thing is so strange to me. Like, first of all, we go through Dale, and I think that looks great. Like, we talked about in Return of the King how I didn't like how Gondor's main city looked, mm-hmm. because it always felt like it was a set to me,
mm-hmm.
or it didn't look like a place where you could actually live. And just from the brief shots, I thought that they did a very good job in making Dale look like a real place. And then, you know, the visual for Erebor was fantastic. Like when they go through all of the mines and the gold river and all that kind of stuff.
That was gorgeous, man.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah. And so getting into like the dwarf and the elf's rift, like that, I love that it makes sense. Cause when I first saw it, I was like, well, this is dumb. Like they're just a bunch of pussies. Like that's why they're not going in there. You know, cause I, you know, full disclosure, I only saw the first movie probably a week ago.
Right.
And then for whatever reason, I just had never got around to it. And so now that, you know, it makes more sense. And I was like what Scotty was beginning to say, like, I was very surprised that they cut that out.
Yeah.
You know,
in the original theatrical version, when Thranduil like turns his back on the back of his elk and looks down at him, and Thorin says, Give us help. Give us help. And he's like, and he kind of just gives him that sideways twist of his neck. And I'm not helping you guys. I'm out of here. You know? And it's like, why'd he do that? That was just kind of rude. And I mean, he's, right. You know, the people in Middle Earth, I mean, you know, you turn your back on one thing in Middle Earth and it could be happening to you next. It's kind of like how I see it. I mean, you know, Smaug one day and some other kind of cave troll the next, you know?
Yeah. I wonder if it wasn't some sort of, I don't know how much studio involvement there would be, or, you know, what kind of table talk, writer's room table talk they have during editing or something. But I wonder if at some point they said, you know, this makes the dwarves look like bad guys right up front, you know, mm-hmm. where that could be a possibility, you know, because when you see the first version and the elves just turn their back, you're instantly against the elves.
Right.
And you're very sympathetic towards Thorin. But when you see this version, and he's asking for help, you're kind of like not as sympathetic to Thorin, because you're like, well, you guys just, you know, you just screwed him over, you know, you guys just right. kind of like taunted him with all this and then turned your back on him and pushed him away. So, I wonder if it was a situation like that, or if it was just like, well, we've got to cut something, you know.
Yeah. Well, what's so strange to me is that the elves get all the way there, so they obviously had heard something was going on,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they get there and they're like, nah, sorry. Right. You know, it's like they take the time and effort to get all the way to that place, and then they're just like, ah, fuck you, and then they just leave.
But you know what though?
I didn't think of it like that.
But you know what though? I think historically what's going on there, if I'm correct, I could be wrong. I'm sure some Tolkien, you know, hijackers are gonna come along and really eat my words, but
sure.
I think what's happening there is that the dwarves and the elves have notoriously had bad blood with each other. They've always not kind of like not disrespect. They kind of always had this unspoken dislike for each other. And I think what happened there was once the king elf once he found out the Arkenstone was found by the elves, or was, you know, this majestic looking thing that was kind of resembled a Silmaril. He wanted to go see it for himself. Once he found that they had it, he just wanted to pay, you know, the proper due respect to see exactly what was going on for self-discovery's sake. Once he got there, it seemed to me almost like, I mean, come on, if he wasn't there to rescue these guys, he had an army that it was like actually probably going to go there and try to do battle with these guys. Because one of the things that they don't discuss in the movie is that the elf that's in charge, the lead elf that's in charge, he's actually a different breed of elf than the ones the elves are in the woods. So he's a higher elf than what the ones are in the woods. So
that's the king, right? That's Legolas's dad.
That's Legolas's father, right?
Okay.
And I guess help for giving people's names, since I know so damn much about this stuff, right? But but anyway, I'll Wikipedia and get my thoughts straight as far as that goes. But anyway, yeah. So I think they might even be leading some kind of attack to some degree, you know, versus going there to rescue in the very beginning. It might be just going, okay, we're gonna, you know, you won't show me the Arkenstone. You won't let me have the Arkenstone, which is rightfully mine as a high elf anyway. Okay, I'm gonna come and take it from you.
You know, saying that it's a Arkenstone, is that how you say it?
Yeah, Arkenstone.
Some of the things that frustrates me about Tolkien is how things sound very similar.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that, and then Oakenshield sounds sort of like that. And then you have the Sauron stuff. And it's like, can't you just make it something else? Like, it's awful close. Like, I can see people in that world talking, and they're like, wait, these are completely different things. Like, what are you talking about now?
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, that's just like a little thing where I'm like, does it have to be so close? Like, geez Louise.
No, I get it. I get it.
Yeah. But anyway, so the first part that I was really struck by how this wasn't the Lord of the Rings is that, we have the Gandalf sequence, but it's the dinner scene with all of the dwarves.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And for me, like, Scotty said that he loved how it was a different thing. Like, it took me this extended edition watch to sort of get comfortable and be okay that it's not the Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I hold those films in such a high esteem where it's like, okay, the blueprint's the same for the most part. The mm-hmm. subject matter is more geared towards younger audiences. But I was like, well, is he going to keep it that way, or is he going to make it more serious? And then when it was a little sillier and, you know, including the dwarves costuming, like the makeup is a little silly, especially for like the heavier ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I don't know. Like the first time I watched it, I was like, I don't know if I really like that. But this time around, like now that my mindset was correct, I feel like I enjoyed it a lot more because I watched it after, you know, for the first time after I had talked to you guys about recording, and I was like, it's kind of like, you know, Scotty and I were supposed to do a show on Elysium, and I watched it and was like, oh, fuck, I didn't like that at all. Like, is that
okay? Oh, you know what? I've watched it since then,
yeah.
And I'm glad that we did not do that because it was not good.
No, it wasn't. It was the white man saving all the brown kids. I was like, oh my God, it was terrible. So anyway, so yeah, we kind of dodged a bullet on that. So, but the dwarf scene in Bilbo is, you know, I love Martin Freeman as Bilbo.
Mm-hmm. He's fantastic in this movie.
Yeah, he's really good. And, you know, some of the notes that you see on IMDb is that, you know, Peter Jackson held up production or rescheduled production so that he could be, you know, he could be Bilbo. Because mm-hmm. he was doing Sherlock at the time.
Mm.
And so they, you know, it's kind of like, no, this is my guy. We're either going with him or we're not, you know, we're waiting.
Right.
So I really like that but I really do like the kind of silly, dwarf sequence and ultimately when it moves into the theme of the film, you know, the dwarf song, which is mm-hmm. the musical cue for the entire film,
right.
That Howard Shore picks up. So that's really a scene that I really have come to enjoy quite a bit.
Yeah. It was brilliant, man, the way it was executed. I mean, it could have been really, really cheeky, but it wasn't. I mean, the idea of these guys, like, kind of sailing down around a campfire, trying to get their heads straightened into the moment of going on this long journey and, you know, kind of reminiscing and lamenting at the same time. It was kind of a bit of a tearjerker for a minute, man, you know, especially in some of their faces, you know, my softer side says anyway. You know, but, you know, it was good. And then, even though I knew what the outcome was, y'all know the outcome is that stage of the game where we're like only 20 minutes into the movie, you know that Bilbo's going to go along on the unexpected journey after these guys.
Mm-hmm.
But, it was the way they had him come to the conclusion of what was necessary to do to help him out was good for me. You know,
His performance was so fantastic that morning when he woke up.
Yes.
And he's like kind of like looking around corners and checking, and he even checks in the fireplace.
Yeah, he's doing what I like is he's doing those little like fist pumps.
Yeah, right.
Like, yeah, they're not here.
And he's like, and it's almost like he's it's like at times it's not a fist pump. It's like there's an imaginary box in the air, and every time he looks in that he like checks that box in the air, right, like right. Oh, not in there. Good, you know, like and he's like got such. There's nobody for him to talk to, but he's got. It's like he is acting with someone. You know, you don't know who it is. It's the house. He's like acting with the house. His performance there sold me, and every time I watch that scene. And he wakes up, I'm like, yeah, this was the right guy from that scene alone.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's like that day after your relatives are going home and, you know, you're glad they were there, but at the same time, you're glad they're gone. But then but then you miss them for a while. And then, you know, when they're gone for a long period of time, it's like, it's not a big deal. So,
yeah,
but it was that kind of thing, you know, and, you know, yeah, you're right. He did a really good job of pulling it off emotionally.
You know, one of the things that I wished that the film had done a little bit more, and I don't know what you guys think about this, is this is a much larger cast than even, you know, the Fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the dwarves are just basically either ignored or they're just kind of there. Like, I couldn't name most of them, right?
Yeah.
And so that was something that I was not, like, disappointed by, but I was like, well, I don't give a shit if these guys get killed or not, really. Like, you know, I was kind of hoping for, I keep going back to this, but I was a real fan of the Boromir character in the first film.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I like him is because, you know, he has the tragic death and you find out that he didn't really want to be there. And, you know, you get all this backstory to where none of these guys in this, except for, you know, Thorin, have much backstory. And you, in the extended edition, you do get a little bit of an addition there that wasn't there before.
Right.
With one of the characters, but a lot of the guys, I was just like, okay, well, why are they there? Like, what are they?
Well, you gotta remember there's the part, you know, when they kind of feel like they're before they even go on the journey and they feel like what are we doing this for? And the old man's talking to Thorin and he makes the comment. He basically says exactly what you said, which is we're a bunch of nobodies. You know, like there is no backstories to be had. Thorin put out the call and these were the only people for whatever reason to say yes. It's similar to like Samwise, you know, later who goes on the journey. He doesn't have much of a backstory, you know, in the movies at least, other than Gandalf told him to go and keep him safe. Mm-hmm. And technically he's kind of just a gardener and a nobody or whatever. Sure, but okay. you over the course of the journey you come to like him, and I think that's kind of the point of these dwarves is they aren't worthy of backstory. They're literally tinkers and toy makers is what he says.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and then Thorin says, but I'll take these tinkers and toy makers because they're the ones who said yes. For whatever reason they chose, they showed up. And I think that's kind of, you know, that's kind of the thing. Whereas in Lord of the Rings, it's like everybody, you know, the Fellowship, it's like everybody's got. It's almost overburdened at times with everybody having a backstory, you know,
at
some point. And here, you know, it's still a movie called The Hobbit, you know, and at times I feel like if there is a downside, especially in the second movie, you'll see, I feel like in a movie called The Hobbit, at times there's not enough of The Hobbit. Mm-hmm. And so for me, them not getting too overburdened with the cast of dwarves is fine with me because it gives me more time for, you know, Bilbo to be down there with, you know, doing the riddles and you know, it being a little bit more about him and not about the big cast.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I can see that. I can see that. I guess, like what I was, yeah, that makes sense. Like the thing that I was getting at is when they're in these big epic fights and is, you know, I just kind of lose, like I start glossing over during some of them.
Yeah, it's like who are you supposed to focus on?
Yeah, because there's just all these people fighting, and I'm like, yeah, it looks great, like it looks really cool, but at the same time, I'm kind of like, all right, well, I've seen a lot of these sort of fights before, and I don't have any emotional investment because I don't know who any of these guys are.
Right.
Yeah. You know? I think there's something to be said about when we see normally when we see fights, you know, and especially in the first one, it's usually they're chasing fights, right? Like they're going into battle.
Oh yeah.
And so in the you know, when we watch the first Lord of the Rings, they're always heading into battle. They're prepared for it. And so we're invested in the person swinging the sword and we're invested in that fight. The majority of the time in this movie, they are running. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going into the fray. They're on the run at all times. So I think there's a sense of, you know, possibly not needing to give you any weight to these characters as they're fighting because they're fleeing. You know, there's not a sense of heroics really happening here. In fact, one of my notes was, one of my notes on the downside, and I guess I need to put this out there. I absolutely love this movie. Like, mm-hmm. I adore this movie.
Yeah.
So any of my notes are like little nitpicks that I have, but, if I did have a big nitpick is that they're on the run and so unheroic most of the time that Gandalf, they had a storytelling flaw I feel like they had was Gandalf just keeps leaving
mm-hmm.
only to be able to come in when they're at the end of, like when they hit a dead end and then he saves them.
Right.
Like every single time they're on the run or they're at a point where Gandalf's like, you're getting on my nerves. I'm going away. And then they go get caught by the trolls.
Mm-hmm.
And then he comes in and saves them randomly at the very end. Or they're down in – was it the Goblin?
Goblin Town, yeah.
Right. Like, again, he decides, like, he needs a break or he's going to go check something out. And he's – I'm leaving you fools. And then they're all in trouble. And then he shows up again and shines his crazy light and he saves them all again. And it's like that's kind of the role over and over that they – so it's almost like they're so unheroic that that's the way out of every single debacle that they get in.
Well, and that continues on with the end scene, and we'll just briefly discuss this where Thorin's finally like, you know, gets his one-on-one and just gets punked, you know?
Right?
And so then they have to save his ass too. So, but anyway, so going back there earlier, I guess I could see that. I don't know. It's such a large cast. I don't know that I.
Like I don't know. I think they punctuated. I think the way they had them arrive showed a level of importance. I think,
of course,
the exception of Thorin being the last one to show up, but he made the graceful late entrance that you know all right. Hollywood stars make. But sure. You know, you could tell from the beginning, and Scotty can vouch for this, that they're going to have that of course Keeley is going to make a bigger role in this. And, of course, he's the most handsome of the dwarves.
You know, you're bringing that up. That was another thing that I actually talked about on the Film Drunk podcast a little bit. One thing that did bug me a little bit about the group of dwarves is, like, in the first Lord of the Rings, we had Gimli, right? And
right.
He kind of, like, in my mind, that's what dwarves are. They're really short. They're really stocky. They're pretty ugly. Like, they're really funky looking, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then in this one, the first dwarves that show up they're funky and they got funky beards. Nobody seems really short or stocky. Like they didn't really do a great job of messing with any of their actual proportions.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times they just look like normal people mm-hmm. with funky haircuts. And then half of them look straight up like men. Thorin and what's his face? What's the one that plays the bigger role in the next movie?
The guy
from Being Human.
Right.
Keeley, right?
Keeley. Yeah.
Yeah, like him. Like, they didn't do anything to him. Like, he's just a straight-up pretty dude. Like,
he should be straight from the CW, man.
Yeah, they didn't even put, like, a big nose. He doesn't, like, they're just like, you know what? Nah, just put this furry coat on. Like, there's no dwarving him up. And so, at times... Unlike the first one where they always were very hyper aware of scale and people being shorter and proportions and all these things, this one, it felt like I was just watching a bunch of guys. I mean, they looked exactly like Bilbo. I mean, you know, as far as size and proportion and everything like that, and except for some of the shorter ones and, you know, fatter ones or whatever, there was like – It they didn't come across as quote unquote dwarvish as I feel like Gimli had shown me, you know, the race could be. So again, that was a minor nitpick, but just out of the two, I was like, yeah, those Thorin, man, he's just like a good looking dude. Like, that's not a dwarf.
Yeah, I guess I took that as because they were all proportionate to Bilbo, they were all just really small. And so it just looked like Gandalf was huge, and he was the kind of the oddly shaped one, and everyone else was just like normal dude size.
Right.
Is the way that it comes off, because they're all around each other or other things that are similar size to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just, I mean, it's kind of nice for Peter Jackson. He doesn't have to do a lot of extra stuff.
Yeah, that's. I mean, it's probably because they had so many that they couldn't. Like, if you remember, Gimli looked so
well, he was
he was so really quote unquote dwarvish that you know. I mean, there would be times where they'd pull back and people were throwing him. You know, like throwing him upstairs and stuff. Like that's that was his size. And even when these guys are standing next to a full grown human man, like. They don't look like you could do that with them. Like, you know what I mean? They don't look like small. They just look like, again, they just look like you're pulling a camera trick on me. As opposed to like a fully different style of people. Which again, I mean, you know, if I'm looking at the budget of it and everything like this, it's not like they can probably go in and, you know, deck out a huge cast like that in, in full, you know, prosthetics on everything to keep it. Looking crazy, but I mean, again, it was a minor nitpick for me.
Sure. Now, Dwight, tell me about the Azog. Is that how you say it? The
Azog. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about him. Is that a Silmarillion thing? Is that a Hobbit thing? Like, what do you know? What that's from at all?
Azog is actually a Hobbit. It's a Hobbit thing.
Okay.
And it's or is it? Yeah, Azog's a Hobbit thing.
Okay, because I didn't know if that was a lead Uruk-hai kind of created for the film thing, like in Fellowship, or the pink guy in Return of the King, or you know how they kind of create them just for the film.
It's kind of a made up thing too, because the actual character that really does most of the work in the books that I remember is actually in this next film.
Okay,
so his son is really a terror, not him.
Hmm.
So his son actually does appear in this next film. Without doing any spoilers.
Sure.
So it's not really Azog. Azog's kind of made up to be the terror which killed, his grandfather.
Right. That was one of the things where I was like a little confused tonally. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we just had a little bit ago this silly kind of singing and playing with the dishes and, you know, just eating all of his food and all that kind of stuff. And it's a little light and airy and, you know, the prologue was a little bit more serious. And then we have this return to that fight and we have the beheading. And I was like, holy shit. Like,
well, it gets worse, dude. Actually, in the book itself, the Azog battle is much more. Actually, the Azog actually takes the grandfather's head and has some dwarvish words carved into it on a mantelpiece.
Oh.
So they can't show that, you know, so it's kind of a different departure. But, you know, there's been a lot of flack from that too. Of course, everybody's the Tolkien purists want to see the freaking book on screen. And, you know, anytime somebody tells me that, as far as that goes, I say, look at The Watchmen. That's what you had. You had the book on screen, and did you like that? No. So, all right, there you go. Then it doesn't work. It doesn't translate well.
So. Yeah, yeah. So I was. I mean, that's kind of my main concern was I didn't like the first watch. Like, I didn't know really what I was getting into, and the way that the tone was going from real light to real serious and just kept kind of bouncing back and forth. And it's the same thing with the second wizard that we meet, you know, because he's got kind of a goofier look with the bird shit all over himself. And you know, he's running away with
Radagast.
Radagast is using the rabbits to run away from these wargs. And I'm like, all right, well.
Did you like Radagast?
I didn't like it. I felt like I was watching like something. You know, his little house looks like the Merlin's house from Sword in the Stone, you know, and because I've been having to see that a lot. So that reminded me directly of Sword in the Stone. And then he's kind of like a kooky wizard type. And I just, it was just really on the more kids scale, I guess. And I just wasn't really. And then when they mashed together with the wargs, I was like, whoa, what the hell?
Yeah,
so, I don't know what I think about it, I guess.
I mean, Radagast, I think of Radagast being a brown wizard and getting disrespected in the council by Saruman.
Right.
You know, because his teeth were brown and because he liked the mushrooms too much.
Right.
You know, you can kind of see his disdain, understand his disdain for him is justifiable, but he is, after all, what they call a Mithrandir. So he's one of those guys that's been around since the beginning, you know, along with the Grand Council of Elves, you know. So, you know, she had a little more respect for him than that. But, I mean, look at his guys, and he has that, you know, bird dung on the side of his head, and it's just like, oh, come on. And that's just, that's a Peter Jackson thing. I mean, he chose to portray him that way. I would have had him look a little bit more noble, a little more respectable than what he did. It was just weird. And he's like this big tree hugger. He just seemed like, he was so concerned about the little fauna and stuff running around in the forest. And I get that. One thing leads to another. There's this big cyclical thing, all the ecosphere, if you will, working together in one great thing. But philosophically, I understand it. But, it just seemed to be a crazy, strange visual, like, faux pas. Like, why would you do that? You spend all this time making these things look great. I know Peter Jackson wanted everything to look great and believable to a certain degree and inside the world of Middle Earth, but that just took me out. I was like, I'm not getting that.
See, I don't know. That might be your city side. That might be your city side making you forget what it's like when you farm people for too long. Like,
right.
Like if as long as he's been around, and in the movie world, if he's the wilderness and he's in the forests and he protects the forests in the east because, evil finds any way to get through or whatever. Like, I take it as, like, at some point, you just realize if I work out in the fields, I have shit on my shoes. Like, right now, I live in a nice subdivision. If I step in dog shit, I'm panicking and throwing up and like, oh, get it off.
Right.
But at some point, if over the course of 500 years I live –
right.
Like in a cow, in the pastures, you get used to things, right? Like that's you're by yourself. You're kind of Looney Tunes. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like if I'm getting nerdy about character design and really like seeping into like what things are like, that's how I would be thinking of it is like if I live in the trees and in the weeds and the grass and animals and things like that, at some point I'm part of it. Like I'm, you know what I mean? Like that's everything's a part of me, like having the nest in his hair.
Yeah.
And, like those kind of weird little things. Now, they definitely played him up as like quirky and kooky. But again, I think it helped me at least create a balance of up and down.
Right.
With tone that I think that the second one lacked. And I think as much as I love the original trilogy, the original trilogy lacks balance of levity. Mm-hmm. Where especially in the extended editions, when you're getting to 3.5, when you're in that 3.5 hour zone, and there's never humor, or there's very little humor, or when
or
it's just,
yeah, or they try and it doesn't work, like with the Treebeard stuff,
right? Because those extended versions of the first movies, I mean, I could watch them a bunch of times, but mostly because I'm at home and I can pause it. And I can half doodle in a sketchbook, or I can, my mind can drift during parts that it would drift. Mm-hmm. Like where this one, I felt like right when, if it was too much of heavy, they would drop in a thing like a Radagast or something that changed up the tone, gave it a little bit more bounce to it. And also, I think in the grand scheme, at some point, people are going to watch these movies. From The Hobbit Unexpected Journey through to The Return of the King.
Right.
Like, they're going to watch these things straight through. And I think that if you were to do that, scenes like Radagast and weird kooky characters like him with bird shit on him and the rabbits and everything being a little fuzzy and wacky are going to play correctly for you because it's setting you up. It's so cartoony that by the time you get to Fellowship of the Ring or Two Towers, where it starts to get really heavy and dark, it'll be like a good arc, for the whole six movies, possibly. That's speculation on my point, but
I get what you're saying, man. I agree with you. I think as far as character design goes, I think he was right where he needed to be. My only problem was is in terms of character design. Like, I mean, come on. Bird dung on the side of your head, dude. That was a bit much. I mean, yeah, obviously you're gonna have it somewhere on you because you live with animals. But even Grizzly Adams, dude. I mean, he knew how to kind of put it where it needed to go. Freaking Marlon Perkins knew how to put it where it's supposed to go. But I mean,
that bird shit might be like Samson's hair, dude. The power's
that's what it is.
I think that's what's kind of corrupting his vision, man. Making his teeth brown, actually. Not the mushrooms.
Not the mushrooms. Yeah. That's when That's when we get, you know, he's running away, and they have that sequence where I do really like that, and it goes a lot to what Scotty was saying earlier about how these guys are trying to avoid fights at all cost. Uh-huh. You know, they're not out seeking a group to take out. And they do have that little sequence where they're trying to hide behind the rocks, and then Gandalf saves the day again and gets him into the Rivendell secret pass. Mm-hmm. Which I was like, that's surprisingly easy to get into Rivendell, like, cause you go through that little tunnel, and granted you have to find it, but then you're just kind of right there.
Right.
It's like, holy shit, there's no, like, security, there's nothing really in the way.
Right.
Well, I think that's a trick of editing, though.
Oh, okay.
Like, I think that once they were down there, they probably had a hike. Like, it was probably like a network. I would assume it's a network of tunnels, right? I mean, cause they still were on a mountaintop.
Right.
So I'm sure they had to go through some tunnels and everything like that. But because we had just spent a good, I don't know, 3 straight minutes of them of walking over mount, you know, doing the traditional Lord of the Rings hike, I'm sure they just was like, we don't need to watch them walking through mines because we're going to have mines coming up, you know.
Sure. Right. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense.
I think in my notes, I think the most useless piece of part of the movie to me was the part where the Stone Temple Pilots, I called them, but that's not what they were. The mountain kings were fighting and throwing rocks at each other.
See, I don't know what that says about the story, but I thought it looked really fucking cool.
It did look cool, but it was so, like, dude, it was useless. I mean, there was no connective tissue whatsoever to the next part other than that Thorin got a chance to diss Bilbo and say, okay, why are you here? It's like, I mean, to help you, you know. Thanks for the gratitude. You know, that's all was really established in that moment, that scene. So, yeah.
I mean, because it looked so cool, and because in the book, like in the book, that scene is so uncool.
Right.
Like in the book, it's like, and the dwarves walked, and they looked over and saw mountain the stone giants throwing rocks. It's like, that's it. And then it's like, that's it. And then when I saw the movie, I was like, whoa, they actually made this cooler than the book.
Because,
you know, they just take a few seconds. And I mean, for me, it was the first time in the movie where I felt like some real danger, right? Like, oh my, I mean, like seeing it in the IMAX, I was like getting some serious vertigo for a minute. You know, they're like on the knee of one of the giants. Like, I don't think it served much of a story purpose. Right. You know what I mean? But it was one of the times where it's like, and you know, there's things in the second one, you know, there's action set pieces in the second one that don't serve much of a story. And they play a long time where this one, I was like, I'm cool with just like a cool set piece for no other reason than doesn't this look cool? You know,
that was got it. Go ahead, Dwight.
From an artistic standpoint, Scott, do you think it was adequately lit? I mean, I had a hard time really discerning who was doing what. No,
it was definitely, it was definitely too dark. Especially if you see, like, in the art, I have the art book.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see it kind of, but especially if you see the art book, you can see, like, they actually had, like, facial features designed on them. And, and so, like, the stones and everything kind of, like, they were, like, weird, mashed up, weird, like, deformed faces in the stone.
Okay.
But I agree with you there completely. Like, it definitely was too dark. And that's one of the things where I wish and the scene that we're leading up to, obviously, is going to – I would speak to this. But it's scenes like that where I wish that Del Toro would have been – would have stayed on, because Del Toro, I think, is a master at lighting and keeping things, you know, funky, cool colors and – you know, I never feel in a Del Toro movie that I'm getting sucked into dark, like, blacks and grays and blues. Like, if he has dark blues, then he also has some hot oranges or weird golds or, you know, funky greens to rim light it or whatever. Mm-hmm. Which I think, you know, the scene following this, the Stone Giants, you know, once they get down into the Goblin City, I know in the special features, you know, they say once Peter Jackson came on, you know, they started from scratch. Mm-hmm. And started over, but
no, but BS.
The Goblin City. The Goblin design, the Goblin King's design, the Goblin City, the lighting of the Goblin City. Like, that whole scene just felt like a Del Toro set piece. Like, it really felt like straight out of a Del Toro movie for me, which I loved.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the mountain thing was the first one where I was like, oh, okay, now I can see a little bit of influence in there from Del Toro. Mm-hmm. Is what I was thinking with the mountain. And then when I saw the got, you know, the scene that Scotty just mentioned, I was like, oh, okay, well, this is obviously a Guillermo del Toro. What do we think about that? Would you guys have rather have seen him take over the trilogy? Or are you happy with what, you know, obviously you guys are big fans of the film, so are you satisfied with it being Peter Jackson, or what do you think?
I think they ought to keep the same timber, if you will, of the film. I think it was necessitated that Peter would be the dominant voice in it. I think he has the kind of pacing that's necessary. I think sometimes what I don't like about Guillermo del Toro's films is the fact his pacing is kind of wonky and kind of crazy, and he's in his own mind, you know, which is okay. I get that. But I think the fact that Philippa Boyens and Fran Walsh are really the real brains behind the operation, so to speak, as far as the writing and stuff goes. Mm-hmm. I think that makes it sing better to me. I think that if Guillermo does really cool set designs and Labyrinth was a great movie based on, you know, to some degree for storytelling, but sometimes it drug a little too far. And I think he's kind of meaner spirited than Jackson is. There's a thing about Del Toro that's like, okay, not only am I going to show the kids getting whacked, I'm going to show their fingers getting cut off too. You know,
right.
You know,
just a little meaner spirited.
It's a little, and I think that comes across in some. Well, you know, I think one of the first times I knew that it was Guillermo del Toro, working with Peter was doing the cave trolls.
Oh, the trolls. Okay.
Yeah, and they were. You know, he goes and he stabs a guy in the butt with a well, how'd it work? It was. Okay, so Bilbo goes and he discovers that the horses have been captured by, you know, are about to be eaten by the cave trolls. Mm-hmm. And one of the cave trolls, you know, sneezes out this mucusy stuff, and he picks up Bilbo by mistake and says, "Look what came out of my nose," you know. And to me, that was a total Guillermo del Toro moment for me, for some reason. Uh-oh, did we lose somebody?
No.
Okay.
You're fine.
Okay. And, you know, I think that was one of the things that kind of said to me, this is a pretty good amalgam of the two storytellers, you know?
Yeah, I forgot about the trolls. I think the reason I didn't think of that at the time was because you get to see Sam and Frodo walk by the trolls mm-hmm. in the first one, and
right.
I just see that and I assume, oh, the character design is the same, so it must have just been a Peter Jackson thing.
Right.
You know, like I think of the look of the Goblin King, and I think he looks so much like a Guillermo del Toro because he's a little bit gross.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I don't ever think it's just like gross in a different way than the way Peter Jackson's gross to me.
Right.
You know, like when could you get like the Uruk-hai being birthed and that sort of stuff? And that is something where you're like, oh, okay. But it doesn't hit me the same way as a Guillermo del Toro creature does, I guess.
Even with the introduction of the deformed orc in the final film?
Yeah, not really, because he looked really phony to me, I guess.
Okay.
Like, I was just like, oh, okay, this is just, you know, it just looked like a heavy makeup job. Like, it didn't look, like, I don't know. It either was too real or wasn't real enough. Like, it was in kind of like a middle gray area to me.
Okay.
You know?
Interesting. Yeah, I get you. So, I mean, now we're in Goblin Town. In the extended version, we had several songs being sung by the Goblin King. And I must confess, I mean, I kind of wanted to hear, even though I know it's not going to be there. It was only supposed to be in the, it only happened in Lord of the Rings. I kind of want to hear Ralph Bashke's song, "Where There's a Whip, There's a Way." Mm. you know, it was such a cool song for the animated story, but you know, I know it wasn't going to happen for various reasons. But you know, I being that I'm kind of a guy that's like lyrically inclined anyway, I wanted to hear the words more spoken with more clarity. So I will go back and I will find the words. I know there was a lot of improvisation in terms of, well, not improvisation, restructuring of the actual words that were stated from the book version to what the movie was. And I'm curious to see what the deviations were and how they adapted it for the movie. But I found it like that added a lot to who these characters were, who the goblins really were. I mean, you know, you have these seemingly like wicked and evil creatures underneath the mountain that eat whatever carrion seems to fall in their wake. But at the same time, you know, they're very cultured. And I think when a character or when a creature or a race can show some degree of artistic appreciation for something or some kind of cultural affluence, you know, it gives more to the character, makes me like them, endears me towards them more. So I didn't see them as being, I think in the theatrical version, like the strangeness between the elves and the
dwarves, yeah.
The dwarves. I felt the same way about the elves or about the dwarves and the goblins. It's like, you know, the goblins are just bad people. And then seeing them sing, it kind of made them less bad to me. That's what I'm trying to say.
You know, I have in my notes here that I enjoyed almost all of the additions, mm-hmm. right? Like, I was really glad that they were in there. But mm-hmm. the one that I liked the most was this one,
mm-hmm.
was the addition of the song and the kind of playfulness, which, you know, I was kind of on this movie's case about the being playful and being serious. Right. But I really liked this from a villainous character mm-hmm. that he, you know, is kind of just playing with them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he doesn't look like he's someone that would be, you know, playing around with him. Right. Right. He's definitely got a distinctive look, but I really like that. Like I was like, oh, okay, well this is fun. Like I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. I thought he had like, I loved that while being a king, he had like, he had like that condescending humor where he was mm-hmm. like, oh, well look who it is. Thorin, son of Thorin or whatever. He's like, king of the mountain, but you don't have a mountain. He's like teasing him and like, almost just like, aren't you just the king thinking you're, it's almost like you're mountain people. We're mountain people. You think you're better than us. There's just so much character in this character, you know, it reminded me a lot of, and they completely got rid of this in these movies, but it reminded me of how the orcs were in the original trilogy, where now the orcs are just like straight evil, like spiky, you know, kill machines. Not right. that they weren't evil in the first one, but in the first ones, the Orakai and all those guys were the crazy wild killers. The mm-hmm. orcs were like, oh, we're going to have some man meat. You know, they're like, they were very like corny and cheesy and almost like they were the cartoon characters out of the first couple movies.
Right.
And I was nice to see some of that kind of like villainous humor inserted into the Goblin King, mm-hmm. Through song and through the way, like I said, that he condescended with them. And then, you know, when he's like asking him a question and the dwarves start like, they're going to explain where they've been and they're like, we're on a road. Well, no, it was a kind of a path. And, you know, and he's kind of
essentially
like,
rolling his eyes like, oh.
Right. Right. Even when he dies, right? Like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Even when he gets cut over, he's like, oh, that'll do it. Like, even as he's dying, he's kind of like, he's still got a humor about it. Like, oh, right, that right. sucks.
Right. It's like, oh, that'll do it.
Yeah. And that leads us into, to the introduction of Gollum in the films.
Got him.
And, the Gollum stuff, like I, you know, Gollum was a big thing for me in the first, you know, trilogy. And so seeing him here and seeing the, you know, the way that CGI had come, you know, because it was 10 years ago or so when the last film had come out, just to see the, not really improvements, because I think he still looks good in the original trilogies, but he just, you know, looks, you know, a little bit even more real or unreal.
Oh, I will definitely say improvements.
Okay.
Like, I mean, the technology, did you guys watch any of the special features?
No, I haven't seen it.
For this?
Well, and see, part of this, Scotty, could be that you watched it originally in IMAX, and I watched the original. I just watched it a couple weeks ago on my TV that's like 40 inches.
Right, right.
So I could definitely see where you could, you know, reap the benefits there.
Yeah, they're definitely. I mean, well, I watched the big 4.5 hour making of, first Andy Serkis is the second unit director on this whole movie.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah,
that's crazy to me.
Big ups, Andy.
And this time around on Gollum, they had basically a camera on his face at all times. So it basically had a head strap and then a camera, like a little arm and a camera facing him. So no matter where he turned, there was always filming every inch of his facial expressions.
Oh, okay.
And so them being able to translate that this time around, it was exact, you know, like the nuance of his expressions. I thought, like, I remember when he first came out and started talking, I was like, whoa. I mean, he was good the first time around, obviously. Sure. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It was leaps, but I mean, this time it was like, this was the first time I think for a CG character, and people can say what they want about Avatar, I don't care. This may have been the first time seeing an actual CG character where I was not thinking, that's a really good CG character. I was just like, whoa, this character's creepy, you know, like, yeah. Just the big eyes and his, just all the expressions were there. And they, like, I think he was, because he wasn't, I mean, he was funny and he was panicked, and I don't know, everything about what they did with him visually, I thought was leaps and bounds above what they had done. And it was just awesome.
I agree. My only complaint about Gollum, if I have one at all, is that, you know, I think his presence, like, just overly fills the scene with everything that he does. It's all about him. And I think to some degree, I don't even see the character anymore. I see Circus. Like, when I look at Gollum, I see Circus, and it's like, okay. I know he's performing at a very insanely manic rate, and I know he's doing a great job doing it, but I also know it's Andy Serkis behind it, you know, and I had to pull myself back into the picture to see Gollum and not look at Andy's performance as much.
Yeah, I think that's one of the downsides to us being in the world that we are, because we love we love every aspect of storytelling and filmmaking, and you know, sometimes once you learn too much, it's hard to unlearn it, you know.
Exactly. You must have learned that what you learned.
I know, right? My next note, along with the Gollum stuff, is if I had to do some of those riddles, I would be dead really quick.
Yeah.
Because not only would I not be able to answer most of them, but I would also not be able to come up with them that quickly. I'd be like, all right, sorry about it. I'm done.
Yeah, that first one, dude, that was a stumper, dude. I'm sorry. The first one with the, you know, the freaking mountain was the answer. It's like, okay, I'm dead already. He's eating me already.
Yeah.
I love that that is an actual nice bit of world building,
mm-hmm.
that you might not, you know, grasp when you first see that scene, because you just think it's two people telling riddles, but it's actually telling you that in this world, this is like maybe the our form of a joke, you know, like, oh, let me tell you a joke. Like, people have riddles ready, you know, like,
yeah, they're just, it's. They got a quiver of riddles just ready.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like our version of like, you know, let's play movie trivia real quick, you know, or whatever. It's they've like, that's what they do to pass the time, is kind of try to stump each other with riddles and everything. And so it's a nice bit of world building, I think, they had going on there.
I agree.
Yeah, I like that. And that kind of leads us, you know, to the sequence where where they're doubting Bilbo again, and they're about to, you know, and I was watching that, and I was like, God, just give the guy a break. Like, I understand, you know, it's not like all of the other dwarves are super capable either, you know, and that's what I was kind of like, God, lay off him. Like, you know.
Well, I mean, Bilbo, here's the thing. If he had just kind of, I guess, and I'm not going to, I mean, I totally agree with the character. I'm totally engaged in who the character is, and I appreciate who he is as a being, so to speak. But at the same time, if he just kind of like manned up from the very beginning, like if he just said, okay, I'm a Baggins, and I'm staying here, mm-hmm. you know. And so we're also a Took, you know, weapons of the little boy, that, which is cool. We didn't talk about that, how they showed the little boy, Bilbo Baggins, like kind of.
Right, that was, that was another little nice ad in the extended version.
That was cool. That was cool. I like that. But, you know, so for him to kind of chastise Bilbo for not paying attention to his full being was kind of cool. But I think, yeah, I mean, you know, you're not a burglar. You're not a cook. What do you do? You know, when they ask him, it's like, you know, well, I'm, you know, Gandalf says, well, he's a burglar, you know, and Gandalf kind of sets him up for that shit, you know, but, you know, I think, you know, he had to earn his way, because you're in the midst of warriors. These people aren't playing. You can go home to Hobbiton, you know, mm-hmm. but we have no home.
Sure.
So, you know, if you're not here to really help out, what the hell are you doing here?
Yeah. You know?
And I think there's a natural thing that we probably all understand, in that we mm-hmm. naturally reject people that aren't part of our crew, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we almost find reasons. Like, he was kind of annoying, which is, if he was a part of my crew, it'd just be like, oh, he's just being him. You know, he's just being annoying. But right. If somebody's being annoying that's not part of your crew, you start looking at each other like, what is this guy doing here? He's the worst. You know, right. Like all of a sudden, it's like everything's amplified because there's a little bit of snottiness. There's a little bit of, you know, them condescending towards him and them being like, I'm king of the mountain. Like, I'm something big. You're right. Just whatever. We had to talk you into coming. So it's like, I think it's more about like less about him convincing them of who he is and more of them having to teach them like other people have struggles like you have struggles, you know? Mm-hmm. That's why I think that scene when he finally breaks him down was a good scene, you know, where it was, you know, he had his little speech and this is why I'm doing this, but you know, it was a lot of people might think that speech was about Bilbo, but it seemed to me to be more about him putting them in their place, you know, mm-hmm. but doing it nicely, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I guess I should clarify, like, I don't think it's a flaw in the film. It's just one of those things where I'm like, oh, come on. Like, just give it, you know,
give him a break.
Yeah. I'm like rooting for, I'm on Bilbo's side. Like, Jesus.
Right.
And then
right.
we get his bit of redemption in their eyes where, like I'd mentioned earlier, where, Thorin gets, you know, they have this like 80s action slow motion like build up. You know, mm-hmm. they're running at the camera and I'm expecting this like involved fight and he just and the warg just whoops his ass.
Yeah. Bites
and,
him.
Yeah, and I was kinda like, oh, like, you know, I was expecting this big involved thing and it just kinda bites him and throws him to the side and you know, Bilbo comes and saves the day or at least buys time and
Well, man, think about it, man. It's just kind of funny. It's kind of a funny parody I saw in that action sequence with the Pale Orc and the original, you know, and the original Lord of the Rings, where the King of Gondor, the original King of Gondor, actually cut the ring off of Sauron's hand.
Sure.
And of course, you know, Thorin cuts the hand off of the Pale Orc. It's like, okay, guys, what don't you understand about not extending your hand, you know, as fully as it can go, and covering yourself at all times? Because that was the fatal mistake they both made, and they both lost their hands that way, and to the downfall of the Empire of Sauron, and to, you know, causing this guy to go into what could have been a victory for the orcs that day,
Bringing that up, if you go all the way back to the beginning, which is this the first scene that he realizes that
he's
the Pale Orc's alive?
I think so.
Yeah.
That is one storytelling flaw that I felt. It was like, who cuts off somebody's arm and thinks they died? Like, in Middle Earth.
Yeah,
like,
get pulled in. He gets like drug into the castle or whatever. Like, he gets drug into the mountain by dwarves. So I think mm-hmm. he just probably assumes they killed him.
Was it dwarves or I thought that he got drug in by his own people.
He did by his own people. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, I completely missed.
Yeah, no, the orcs grabbed him and saved him. So I was like right. I was like, is this Middle Earth? Like you guys throw like magic stuff at each other and there's like power there's like rings of power and there's all types of craziness and there's like dragons and giant flying birds. And you just cut half his forearm off.
Right.
Like, did you guys really go the next 15 years thinking you killed him?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
That was one thing there. I thought they could, like, it didn't make sense that they were so, like, we killed him. I could cut his arm off. His people, like, drug him away. My first thought would be, like, damn, I should have killed him. You know?
Right. Right.
Well, I do like the fact that they use that as a kind of a character piece, though, because some of them know, you know, a couple of them know that he's not dead, including Gandalf, and he obviously doesn't know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I kind of like that they have that, not seeds of dissension, but at least, you know, that not everyone is all on the same page kind of a thing.
Now, right. was it, did they know, or was it just they, you know, I think Gandalf kind of sensed that he was still alive?
Yeah, maybe they just suspected. They just have that, like, kind of knowing look at each other.
Right, well,
the Goblin King, wasn't the Goblin King who told him, right?
Goblin King confirmed it.
They were down there, and he said, there's a bounty on, you know, whatever, they're after you, the Pale Orc is after, or whatever, somebody said the Pale Orc or something. And they're like, oh no, Thorin killed him. And he was like, the Goblin King was like, yeah, no, I don't think so. Like, you might think he's dead.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and then we have the, you know, the little bit of attempt of tugging on the heartstrings with Thorin's finally accepting Bilbo.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then they see the Misty Mountain and you follow the bird and you see the reveal of Smaug and it ends. Mm-hmm. So how did you guys like that in terms of a place to end? Do you think that is about as much sense as it could have made, or what did you think of that? Especially seeing the second one already.
I mean, I think it works if when you put it all together, like Scotty says, when you put them all together in a row, all your ducks in a row, it's all going to evolve into a nice six part, you know, story. I think, you know, the cliffhanger there, I mean, it was a bit on the cheek, you know, who didn't know that it was going to go check at the very end? They're going to show Smaug at some point, yeah. You know, mm-hmm. It was because they didn't show him at all in the very beginning. He was just this big wraith-like character that went through and wreaked havoc, you know, all he saw was pieces of body and this big motion captured, you know, crazy looking beast thing that was just destroying everything inside the castle. So inside Erebor. So I don't know. I was expecting it. I wish they could have, like, I don't know. It was just a crazy setup for me. Like I guess if you liken it to the first films wherein, Samwise and Frodo are about to go across the waters to, or the swamp to get to, Mount Doom. You know, you kind of played in your heartstrings more. This is kind of like, you know, leading into something else, obviously. Like, it didn't have the same kind of gravitas to me. It just, mm-hmm. Okay, we're getting you from point A to point B, and this is how we're going to do the transition. And I was like, okay, fine, we get that. That's why, because to me, I mean, it's only supposed to be one book anyway, one film, you know, at the most. So for you to have this extra budget to be able to allow yourself to this moment of levity and relaxation where, you know, Thor miraculously gets revived by one pass of Gandalf's hand and you know, the birds come along and, you know, it was great. And of course, Thorin has to be a smart ass one more time and say, you know, when I said I couldn't, I this is why you're here. And I'm glad you are. You saved my ass, so to speak, in a long, you know, long story made short. I felt like that was a good place to leave off, but, you know, to go further, and that bird traveled a hell of a distance in a short amount of time to get there and cause a little bit of a disturbance to Smaug, who's been sleeping underneath the, under the gold for all that time.
Sure.
So,
Scotty, what did you think of the end?
Well, here's the thing. I was fine with the end when I saw the movie.
Uh-huh.
When the beginning of the second movie started, I wasn't so – it felt like – it didn't feel like a great ending.
Okay.
Which I don't think spoiling the beginning of the next movie.
No, I'm not. I mean, it's not a spoiler, but I'm not worried about spoilers at all. So just
no, it's not really a spoiler. It's just that the second, you know, the first movie ends with that, like, boom, his eye pops open and the bird. But then the first movie or the second movie does not start at that point. Like,
right.
You know, where the original trilogy, like, each movie kind of picked up where the first one, you know, the previous one ends.
Right.
Like, you know, like, if they're getting ready to cross the river, they're kind of like that. They're kind of on that trek still when you start up the next one. Where this one was like, I thought that once I saw the second one and the fact that, you know, Smaug not only is not at the beginning of the movie,
mm-hmm.
When they do get there, he is still full blown sleeping. Like,
mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? He's not, or, you know, I can't remember exactly, but it's not like he's in there, like, chilling out with his gold, like,
right.
You know, smoking a cigar. He's still buried. Like, so really that ending to this movie was strictly, like, it was kind of a fan service thing, not really a connective tissue to mm-hmm. the beginning of the next movie.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Dwight could tell you, you wait a long time to see good old Smaug.
Yeah. He obviously was a big part of the budget. I mean, he was just like, because it's so rewarding when you do see them, and his voice is very, like, I'm always impressed by the fact that they give these, like, strong British actors with all this just gravelly, you know, erudite undertone to play these roles, because that's what you see. Like, when I read the books, I was hearing the voice this guy was portraying. Not the crazy cartoon version. So I was very impressed by that. Kind of a Lord Vader, you know, Emperor Palpatine type of thing, you know, James Earl Jones all over the place. So, you know, It felt right to me. But what Scott is saying is true. Like, you don't see Smaug for it to be called Desolation of Smaug being the main focus. You don't get a chance to observe his desolation until probably the last half hour or hour.
Oh, yeah. It's half hour. Movie, you're in the movie for 2 hours before the dragon's there. Which is fine. Which is fine. But had they just ended on the cliff looking off at the mountain, mm-hmm. Now having seen the second one, that's where I think that they should have done it. I don't think they should have done kind of the pandering, eye opening, the dragon, Smaug's eye opening at the very end.
Yeah.
Especially when it's like, yeah, you guys filmed this. You guys filmed all this at once. You know, it's not like you made this movie and then, a couple years later, you decided to make another one. That's the kind of thing. That's the kind of ending that a movie gets when you don't know if you're going to get another movie.
Yeah. If you look at what's interesting too, Scott, if you look at the colors of Smaug's, if you look at the as brown as eye, and right. In this version, and the first time you see Smaug, he's got that patinaed look that comes from things sitting too long on metal,
right? Yep.
Around his eye. That's not even present when you finally see Smaug in the film. It's gone. Yeah. It's like, what the hell?
It's just a moment that I think could have. It was definitely maybe a little bit of an indulgent moment that I don't think needed to be there. And it's a nitpicky of me, but I was absolutely fine with them, getting on the cliff being like, there it is. There's our destination. Even mm-hmm. though I'm like, these birds have really got to start just dropping you guys off at the place you need to go. Like, if the birds are going to take you some of the way, just have them go a couple more miles.
Now, but Smaug is voiced by Benedict Cumberbatch, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's the necromancer. Is that something that is a bigger role in the second film?
Oh yeah.
Okay, I was gonna say because they
get to the reveal of that, man. It's just...
I was gonna say they have a pretty prominent, actor, especially right now. And to have him just kind of be in all shadow in the first film, I was like, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
Oh, he's not seen.
Okay, he looks the same in the second one.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Scott, I don't know. Well, let's not go there.
I don't want to spoil what it is, but I mean, I'm saying you don't see Benedict's face.
Okay.
You don't see that actor in the movie.
You don't see Khan on screen.
Exactly.
No. I do feel like the second one. The second one adds a lot of extra stuff. Like, you'll see. Did you say you had read the book? Or no?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, the second one is the one I think adds a lot. That's not in the book, because obviously at some point they've got to start padding this thing out, because there is not enough material to warrant three-hour movies. So they definitely pad out some stuff and characters and add things and things like that. Mm-hmm. And for me, the one thing that just feels weird and tacked on is the necromancer stuff. Some of that stuff feels a little clunky at times, but,
It's there in the books, but it's not like the way you have it in the movie.
Right. And that's why I said it's not, it feels tacked on, not that it's made up. It just feels clunky, at times, but is in the book, is he, again, I definitely don't want to spoil this for you, but in the book, does he become the visual that we see in the second one?
No.
That's what I was like, this is some weird fan service pandering stuff right here.
Yeah. They're trying to make it fit, man. But I mean,
they're really trying to do the tie together to the other movies.
Here's the thing. Here's what's happening, Scotty. And I think what's happening is, in hindsight, Tolkien wanted to take The Hobbit, and he started making the versions of The Hobbit fit
right.
The Lord of the Rings. I think what hindsight has allowed Fran Walsh and Filippa and Peter to do is to take those
and tie it all together.
Right. Exactly. And make it more what Tolkien's vision might have been if he had a chance to complete it. I think that's what they're trying to do.
And I'm fine. I'm fine with it. I mean, it feels that way. And sadly, again, sometimes I wish that I could watch these things from my 18-year-old self.
Right.
Before I had any business, knowledge, or I wasn't, on the side of the entertainment business or any of that stuff where, I wasn't always looking at it through that lens.
Right.
Because, things like that wouldn't even register as a negative to me. Mm-hmm. And not that it's a really big negative, but sometimes you just see that and you're like, oh, that feels a little clunky. Whereas, you know, 14 years ago, I would have just been, sweet, that's right. That thing, you know.
Right, right. Man, what'd you think of, I mean, there's a lot of undertones in this movie too that I like. I like the, and it's been, it was kind of alluded to in the first time we saw, Galadriel and Gandalf get together and have a conversation. There's a spark there, man. I mean, it's not supposed to be there, but it is. They're playing that up in a big way because Galadriel's got a dude, you know?
Well, here's, I think what it did, it showed me that, it feels like there's just dudes are just in love with her. Like, right. And she's pretty good at, like, it seems like anything that they say to her, because if Gandalf in this time around felt very similar to the way Gimli was in the first one, right? Where Gimli was just like, oh, I'm a stalker, give me your hair, you know? I'm just creepy, I just want some of your hair.
Right.
Where this was kind of like Gandalf's reaction to her wasn't as if we're sharing something. It was as if, like, all of a sudden he felt like a 10-year-old and, or, you know, he was the 14-year-old. He was the freshman and some senior girl, you know, just like came and gave him a, you know, a peck on the cheek. And he's just like, oh, you know, like, right. That's amazing.
Right.
It didn't feel as much like it was a shared relationship as much as it was like, she's this like ancient being and he's kind of like an older withering wizard guy. And he's like, she makes him feel like he's this young kid, like, oh my God, I can't believe she's paying attention to me kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was interesting, man. There was definitely, I don't know. I may have read more into it than I should have, but I just felt like there's some kind of, I don't know, like some kind of, passion understanding that goes beyond just the dramatic situation they're in right now.
For sure.
At the same time, I mean, in the movie, she was having a conversation with him while he's been berated by Christopher Lee as Saruman, which is – Christopher Lee was looking really, really old, dude. I mean, he's
Well, again, if you didn't watch the – watching it in the theater, that scene was the first one. And that was one of my notes here on the overall in this movie. I did feel like this movie and the second movie as well, a lot of – where I didn't ever feel like this the first time around. And I hate to keep comparing it to the first trilogy, but
– it's inevitable.
A lot of scenes did not feel like everybody was in the same room with each other. And that scene that we're talking about, you know, with Christopher Lee, until I watched the special features, when you realize that he wasn't there, but when I was watching it in the theater was the first time when I was like, they're not showing these two talk to each other. They're, you know, these are just one shots. They're just like back and forth. And then when you watch the special features, you realize it's because Christopher Lee is literally too old to, like he could not fly to where they were filming, so they basically just filmed him wherever he was or wherever he lives, and they flew there, filmed his scenes there, you know, because he's actually a little too unwell to fly anywhere, and because he is actually that old.
Yeah, he's an old man.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. He was old. He was in his 40s when James Bond was when he was. He was the same age or around the same age as freaking Sean Connery when he fought Sean Connery in James Bond.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this is an old guy. He's in his, what, 80s now, isn't he? Damn near?
Oh, I think he's in his 90s, dude. I could be wrong. You know what? I think I have this magical box here in front of me. I'm going to look. While you guys continue to talk, I'll look it up.
Sure. Well, Dwight, did you have anything else in your notes that we may have skipped over or anything like that we haven't mentioned?
91. He's 91.
Jeez. Wow.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah, dude. So yeah, so he's earned every stripe, every crevice in his long, you know, protruding face. Mm-hmm. No further notes. There were some mental ones I had made, but I can't recall those right now. So that's, you know.
Sure. What about Scotty? What about you? Is there anything else that you would? Wanted to mention that we had glossed over or skipped or anything like that?
No, we hit all the moments that were added in. When I first watched it, I was afraid that I wasn't going to be able to catch all the things added in because, you know, again, going back to the original trilogies, there was a lot more stuff added into those. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a few of them, there were like 45 extra minutes added. So there was, you know, there was, and it, a lot of times it was scattered throughout. So sometimes, And those came out far enough away from me having seen them in the theaters that I wouldn't be able to actually remember what got added or what wasn't in the original. So I thought that it was going to be like that this time, but I caught most of it. Overall, I think we basically nailed all of it. Like I said, I loved this movie for its sense of adventure.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like the first one being so war heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And very emotional, and everything's on the brink of death, and
mm-hmm.
It's gloom and doom, and this one just had such a sense of adventure. You know, it mm-hmm. was like it was a fantasy adventure movie, and I haven't seen one of those and since I was a kid. You know, like
mm-hmm.
where the point of the movie was an adventure, not war and not mm-hmm. killing. So that's why I really really enjoyed it, and. You know, really went with it, even if it got cartoony at end points, and again, why some of me didn't enjoy so much the second one, because I feel like they abandoned, you know, because it's the sad thing is it's three acts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Each movie's going to be three acts, and the second act's always the long, kind of you know downtrodden one and slower one. So that very much felt like the second act movie where they got rid of a lot of the humor and.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not as much bouncy stuff going on. And for a movie called The Hobbit, it's not really that much about The Hobbit. You know, it's just like, this is something. So this one for me really set a high mark. And I remember when I left the theater, I wanted to do two things. I wanted to like rush home and like write and draw
mm-hmm.
and go right back and watch it again. You know, like I was just like, God, that was so fun. So yeah, this was definitely a big high point of my movie year.
Yeah. I know that for me, like coming to this late, I was, like I had mentioned at the beginning, I was a little worried because I didn't love it the first time I watched it. And then once I kind of realized and got myself to understand what the film is, not what I wanted it to be, you know, that it is different than the original trilogy, then I enjoyed the extended edition much, much more than mm-hmm. I did the theatrical. And so I was really glad to see that, you know, I was glad that, you know, we decided to talk about this one and not just the theatrical version. And then we're doing it now before, you know, once it had come out. But yeah, so I would say that, you know, I really enjoyed it. It was, you know, I was kind of let down a little bit. Like there's some parts that I don't really dig on so much about Return of the King. So I was glad to see, this one kind of, you know, bring back the sense of wonder that I have with the Tolkien world, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
So, are we good? Is there anything else you guys wanted to mention or anything like that? Or are you ready for me to wrap her up here?
I mean, that covers all the bases as far as I'm concerned for the most part. I mean,
yeah. All right. Well, wrapping us up then. If you have any comments, suggestions, or movies that you'd like to hear us talk about specifically for Podshots, you could email us at plainlabelpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow the show over at Twitter under the handle @plainlabelpod, where you can follow me. I'm @EricWilliams79. We also have a Facebook page for this show. You can like it, just search for Plain Label Podcast. And just like our regular show, we do have Amazon links on our website, which is plainlabelpodcast.tumblr.com. If you click on the link and buy the Hobbit Extended Edition, we do get a little bit of that money, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. And since you're already over there on our site, we do have a little Amazon box over on the right-hand side, just below where the movie links are. If you click on that box, it takes you to Amazon's homepage. And what we would like is if you would bookmark that link, and then anytime you buy anything from Amazon, we do get a little bit of money, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. So I would like to thank both Dwight and Scotty once again for coming on and discussing The Hobbit with me. If people wanted to get in contact with you or hear more from you, where could they do so, Dwight?
Well, sidebarnation.com, jdoblogspot.com. All those good places.
It is, Dwight Clark Art on Twitter. Is that right?
It is.
Okay. And is that it?
That's it.
Okay. Scotty, how about you?
It's pretty much just, Scotty Young anything, right? So Scottie Young, .com, Scotty Young, at Scotty Young on Twitter. Scotty Young, .com is my Tumblr. So that takes you straight there. Scotty Young on Instagram. Any of those things that need a name, it's just Scotty Young. Except Facebook. I only do Facebook for family and close friends. So don't
bother.
Yeah.
So don't be hurt when I deny you on Facebook.
You can go to Scotty's fan page if you want to just...
Yeah, I do have a fan page, yes, yes.
Yeah, so there you go. Well, thank you for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a discussion on The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug.
Far over the misty mountains rise, leave us standing upon the height. What was before, we see once more. Is our kingdom a distant light? Fiery mountain beneath the moon, the words unspoken will be there soon. For home a song.